Terrorism is at an all-time high. What seemed once to be confined to the Middle East now spans the globe in destruction and death. Recently, terrorist strikes in Brussels, Paris, even in our own country in San Bernardino, California, it reminds us that no one is safe anywhere from the touches of terrorism. But beyond the horror of the destruction and the tragedy of the deaths, the question lingers, why? Why do people engage in such activity? It's such a waste. It seems so pointless. And the answer to the question of terrorism is intimidation. Intimidation is a favorite ploy that's used to frighten people into submission or surrender. Street gangs, members of the mob, utilize this tactic to maintain their control over others in their own organization. They may not always use the force of which they boast. They may not even have it. But the mere threat of it often accomplishes its purpose, to hold sway over a person's emotions and to dominate their actions. Now, the fuel on which intimidation feeds is fear. Fear captivates, fear distracts, fear distorts the truth of the situation. Fear causes people to make hasty decisions that they later regret. Fear often motivates men and women to act contrary to their better judgment. Now, the opposite of fear is confidence. Yeah, confidence can be empty bravado when there's no foundation for it. But when there exists firm evidence that one's own strength and resources are a match for those who wish to terrorize them, the power of intimidation is diminished. And what we see tonight in Joshua chapter 10 is that the Israelite army faced intimidation by their enemies. And they had to make a decision: are we going to be controlled by fear and intimidated by the enemy, or are we going to be motivated by faith? That confidence based on the power and the promises of God. And we're going to see that we have that same decision to make today in our spiritual warfare, because just as those Canaanite nations tried to intimidate the Israelites in the Old Testament, so Satan and his spiritual forces try to intimidate us today. And we have that same choice. Are we going to react in fear, or are we going to respond in faith? Now, as we open the 10th chapter of Joshua, we're introduced to several leaders who wanted to frighten the Israelite army. Beginning in verse 1, "Now Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, heard that Joshua had taken Ai and totally destroyed it, doing to Ai and its king as he had done to Jericho and its king, and that the people of Gibeon had made a treaty of peace with Israel and were living near them. He and his people were very much alarmed at this, because Gibeon was an important city, like one of the royal cities. It was larger than Ai, and all its men were good fighters. So Adoni-Zedek, king of Jerusalem, appealed to Hoham, king of Hebron, Piram, king of Jarmuth, Japhia, king of Lachish, and Debir, king of Eglon. 'Come up and help me attack Gibeon,' he said, 'because it has made peace with Joshua and the Israelites.' Then the five kings of the Amorites, the kings of Jerusalem, Hebron, Jarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon, joined forces. They moved up with all their troops and took up positions against Gibeon and attacked it." See, these kings realized that by themselves they were sitting ducks. This Israelite invading army had already taken out Jericho, which at that time was probably the strongest of all of the cities in Canaan. They wiped out Ai, which, you know, maybe not such a big deal because Ai was a little small town. But then the Gibeonites, the town of Gibeon was an important city that boasted a strong army. They wouldn't even fight them. They made a peace treaty with these Israelites. And so these other kings realized they didn't have a chance. So they banded together. They decided, let's combine our forces and we'll be a much more imposing army coming against our enemies. They thought they could intimidate the Israelites. And part of intimidation is the fear of being outnumbered. It whispers in our ear, the odds are against you. You're going to lose. So you see that terror is the opposite of faith. You know, one daily reality in which the intimidation of being outnumbered appears is in peer pressure. It says, come on, everybody else is doing it. You don't want to be left out, do you? And we all know what that was like when we were growing up, those difficult teen years. It always seemed like everybody was doing this, and mom and dad said, don't do that. But everybody's doing it. There was pressure there. And the same tactic is used by our enemy to keep us from doing what's right. The devil comes to us and says, oh, if you do that, everyone's going to laugh at you. To the businessman, he says, go ahead and follow the rules and watch everybody else pass you by. To one making a stand against injustice, he says, what is one person like yourself going to accomplish against the whole society? See, there's the fear of being outnumbered, of being alienated. That's what intimidation is all about. And our enemy loves to use it. And we need to be reminded of the promise Jesus made in John 16:33. He told his followers, in this world you will have trouble. That word literally is persecution. It's going to happen. But take heart. Don't respond in fear. Don't be terrorized. Why? Jesus says, I have overcome the world. Victory is ours, even when the enemy appears to outnumber us. There's the story of Elisha when he's in this little village and the whole Syrian army comes and surrounds the village because they want him. And his servant goes out and says, we're in trouble, Elisha. And Elisha goes out and says, I don't know what you're talking about. There's more for us than against us. And the servant couldn't understand. What are you talking about? We're just this little village, and they don't even have an army, and there's a whole Syrian army around us. And Elisha prayed, Lord, open the eyes of your servant. And the servant looked around, and he saw angels in chariots of fire surrounding the town. And at that point, the fear was gone. The terror was lifted, and he knew that God would win. And we have that same promise. God has said, I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. There is nothing you will pass through that you cannot survive because I'm going to be there with you. When you pass through the waters, I'll be there. When you go through the fire, I'll be there. God never leaves us alone. And remember that God in one person is always a majority. Now, in the context of Joshua 10, what you see is an indirect attack. Rather than this coalition of kings going against the Israelite army, they go against the Gibeonites. They go against the people that just made the treaty with the Israelites. And we say, why would they do that? Well, they figured one of two things would happen. Either the Israelites would say, well, we're not going to help those guys anyway, and they would be defeated. And perhaps they could capture some of these good fighting men of the Gibeonites to join their side. Or they could pull the Israelite army into this battle they'd really rather not fight and have an advantage. But we see that the Gibeonites sent word to Joshua and said, don't abandon us. Remember, you signed on the dotted line. You got to come help us. And Joshua is faced with a choice. He could have looked at the odds, which on the surface were against him. I'm sure he had a little voice whispering in his ear saying, you don't need to defend those Gibeonites. I mean, remember, they deceived you. They tricked you into all this. You don't have to do that. But Warren Wiersbe writes, "The mistakes we make embarrass us, especially those mistakes that are caused by our running ahead of the Lord and not seeking His will. But we need to remember that no mistake is final for the dedicated Christian. God can use even our blunders to accomplish His purposes." Somebody defines success as the art of making your mistakes when nobody's looking. But a better definition would be the art of seeing victory where others see only defeat. So even though he might have been tempted to abandon the Gibeonites and avoid this confrontation, Joshua decided to trust the Lord. And that is the opportunity of faith. He looked beyond the external circumstances and he saw the eternal realities of God's presence, God's power, and he knew they were on his side. See, we talk often about walking by faith and not by sight. To walk by faith is to see earth from heaven's point of view. To walk by sight is to see heaven from earth's point of view. And oftentimes, we look up to heaven and say, "God, what are you doing? Where are you? How could you possibly be doing this?" We're looking at heaven from earth's point of view. It's when we can take the perspective of heaven to see that God is at work on earth, that's what walking by faith is all about. It's knowing that God is at work. Now, we may not know all the details, and that's okay because we're putting our trust in the one who does. So rather than being intimidated by the enemies, Joshua and the Israelites placed their trust in the word of the Lord. And you read in verses 7 and 8, "So Joshua marched up from Gilgal with his entire army, including all the best fighting men." You know, again, he might have said, "Well, I don't want to risk my best people for these Gibeonites." But he had given his word, and he was a man of his word. The Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid of them. I have given them into your hand. Not one of them will be able to withstand you." Can you imagine that? Could you just imagine getting that kind of assurance from the Lord? Go on up there. The odds might look like they're stacked against you, but not a one of them will stand. He does give us those promises. We have those promises in the spiritual realm. We have the victory. It's ours. God has already promised it to us. And here we see, just as at the beginning of the book, when God had told Joshua, "I'll be with you every step of the way, no one will be able to stand against you," he just reiterates those promises of victory again. But that victory is dependent on obedience. Trusting God in His word is the key to victory. And when that decision is made, faith counteracts fear and it ventures forth based on the promises of God. Fear, on the other hand, holds back. Fear says, "I don't know. I'm not sure I should maybe go do this because I might fail." You probably already have. When we get our eyes off of the Lord, it's just like Peter when he was walking on the water toward Jesus. As long as he had his eyes on Jesus, he was fine. And he's walking right across those stormy waves. It's when he took his eyes off of the Lord. And it says that he was captured by fear. Fear took over for faith. That's when he began to sink. So Joshua kept his eyes on the Lord and on his word. Now notice, he doesn't just sit back and say, "Okay, God, you take care of it." You see a very active faith. Verse 9 says, "After an all-night march from Gilgal, Joshua took them by surprise." And God will always work through our obedience. Now it's true, God has said, "I have a plan and I have the power and my purpose is going to prevail. But if you want to be a part of this, you need to obey. You need to comply." We're reminded of this in the story of Esther. Remember the story of Esther? She was the queen of Persia, but she did not tell the king that she was Jewish. And the king's advisor, Haman, had kind of ramrodded this law through the court, that all the Jews were to be annihilated. Mordecai goes to Esther and says, you need to do something. You need to stand up. You need to make your voice heard to the king. You're the only one who can do this. And I'm sure Esther was kind of hesitant, because even the wife, even the queen, was not allowed to come unannounced into the presence of the king. She literally took her life in her hands. And I love what Mordecai says to her. He doesn't say to her, if you don't do this, we're all doomed. He doesn't say, if you don't do this, we're all going to be defeated. What he actually says is, if you don't do this, God will raise up salvation somewhere else, but you're going to miss out. That is a great principle in our lives as well. We do not hold God hostage. I've heard people say that.
God can't do anything unless you do it.
That makes us God. Okay? God will work out his will. His plan will prevail. His purpose will prevail. The only question is, are we going to be a part of that or not? And the only one that will answer that question is you and I. When we place our trust in him and we obey his word, we act in faith, we put ourselves into God's purpose and plans. If we refuse, God's purpose and plan is still going to move forward. We're going to be left out. So Joshua and the army cooperated in God's plan. They moved in his direction. Now, it might appear that Joshua gains a great victory here, but if you really read the story, you find that somebody else is responsible for the victory. Verses 10 and 11, the Lord threw them, being the enemy, into confusion before Israel, who defeated them in a great victory at Gibeon. Israel pursued them along the road, going up to Beth Horon, cut them down all the way to Azekah and Makkedah. And as they fled before Israel on the road down from Beth Horon to Azekah, the Lord hurled large hailstones on them from the sky, and more of them died from the hailstones and were killed by the swords of the Israelites. Who's being outnumbered here? It certainly wasn't Joshua and the Israelites. Now, I'm sure some might just chalk it up and say, wow, Mother Nature turned against them. No, this was definitely the hand of God. This is a miraculous occurrence. How do we know that? Because the hailstones fell from heaven, but only hit the enemy. Did you notice that? None of the Israelites were knocked out by the hailstones, only the enemy, and more were killed by the hailstones than by Israel's swords. This is definitely the supernatural help of God, which gave them the victory. We see another way in which God uses forces of nature to play a role in this battle, verses 12 through 14. On the day the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, O sun, stand still over Gibeon. O moon, over the valley of Aijalon. So the sun stood still and the moon stopped till the nation avenged itself on its enemies, as is written in the book of Jasher. The sun stopped in the middle of the sky and delayed going down about a full day. There has never been a day like it before or since, a day when the Lord listened to a man. Surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. Again, supernatural occurrences that take place, reminding us that it is God who gives the victory. And ever since this took place, scientists and theologians have debated, trying to explain this elongated day. I don't think we need to get into the minutiae of how it took place. We just know that it did, and we know that God was the one who did it. And the bottom line is verse 14 ends, surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. Through all of this, Joshua and the Israelites, they were able to overcome the outnumbering foes. They are able to beat the odds because of their trust in the promises of the Lord. And you know, that same opportunity for trust is available for us today. Jesus said in Matthew 17:20, because you have so little faith, I tell you the truth, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it'll move. Nothing will be impossible for you. When we make that conscious decision to put our trust in God, regardless of the consequences, nothing is impossible for us. No situation is hopeless. We can never resign ourselves to the conclusion, well, I couldn't help it. Wiersbe puts it so well, we do not have to have great faith. We just need to have faith in a great God. So that even a little tiny bit of faith will accomplish great things, because it's not our faith that's doing it, it's God. We're just allowing Him to work in our lives. But again, the decision is ours, just like it was for Joshua. We can listen to the terror of the enemy's intimidation, or we can look to the promises of the Word of God and trust Him to see us through. Now, whenever that route of faith is chosen, the outcome is always the same: triumph. And it's not triumph by a small margin. It is total. Moving down to Joshua 10:16. Now the five kings had fled and hidden in the cave at Makkedah. When Joshua was told that the five kings had been found hiding in that cave, he said, roll large rocks up to the mouth of the cave. Post some men there to guard it. But don't stop. Pursue your enemies. Attack them from the rear. And don't let them reach their cities. For the Lord your God has given them into your hand. Joshua is telling the Israelites, don't quit now. Things look really good, but the job isn't done. And we need to make sure we're not satisfied before victory's complete. Too often a soldier is finished off by an enemy that they had the upper hand, but they didn't complete the job. And when the Lord gives victory over Satan, we need to make sure that victory is complete. Now, the certainty of victory is evidenced in verses 25 and 26. Joshua said to them, do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Be strong and courageous, just like he was told in chapter 1. This is what the Lord will do to all the enemies you are going to fight. Then Joshua struck and killed the kings and hung them on five trees, where they were left hanging on trees until evening. You might ask, was this really necessary? I mean, it seems kind of extreme. Maybe Joshua was indulging in a little showboating, you know, making a mockery of these other kings. I don't think so. I think the display of these defeated foes was a tangible sign for the Israelites in the complete victory they had won. And I think there are times in our lives where it's good to have a tangible display of the victory that Jesus gives. A baptism is one that serves that purpose. Other believers are there to witness our testimony in Christ. I remember one vivid case when I was in college. We had a fellow student that was just being brought down by guilt over things that had happened years before. Things he had confessed, things he had found forgiveness, but the devil was just bringing him down. And I had told him, I said, I want you to get a piece of paper and I want you to write all of these things down. And he said, well, I don't want anybody to see it. And I said, no one's going to. I want you to write them down and put them in an envelope and seal it. No one's going to read it. So he did that. And we got together. There was a group of us and we prayed and we set fire to that envelope with that list inside. And as he watched that paper with all of these things he had felt guilty over being consumed to where there was nothing left, it was a tangible evidence that his sins had been taken away. And he found that victory. Sometimes that'll work. Sometimes we need that. And I think God understands that. So it might take such a visible evidence, and that's okay. Now, where is the lesson for us today? The lesson of this victory is visualized in the shield of faith, in the armor of God described in Ephesians 6, verse 16 says, in addition to this, take up the shield of faith with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. I don't know if you knew this, and I didn't realize to the extent this is true, But the armor that Paul talks about there in Ephesians 6, many of these pieces are brought in from the Old Testament. There are Old Testament passages that speak of Isaiah 59:17 speaks of righteousness as a breastplate, the helmet of salvation. 2 Samuel 22:36, give me your shield of victory. And that word for victory and faith are very closely related in Hebrew. Psalm 91:4, his faithfulness will be your shield and rampart. And the idea here is that God is really the warrior who has gained the victory. We have the benefit of his protective armor. Now, if you look at the armor of God in Ephesians 6, there's three pieces we're to have, meaning we're to wear them all the time. He says we are to have the belt of truth. We're to have the breastplate of righteousness. We are to have the shoes of the gospel of peace. But the other three parts of the armor, we are to have at hand. We're to take up, ready to pick them up when needed. Paul switches verbs here in Ephesians 6, telling us to take up the shield of faith, the helmet of salvation, and the sword of the Spirit. Maybe a good way to understand this, try to imagine a baseball player. Before the game, he suits up in his uniform. And he doesn't remove that uniform. He's got his uniform, he's got his shoes, probably some kind of cleats. And he wears those throughout the game. But at different parts of the game, he'll pick up the bat, or he'll pick up his glove, he'll pick up the helmet, as it's needed. And it's the player's responsibility to grab them and to use them at the appropriate time. You know, no one forces him to do that. Just as God doesn't force the shield of faith, the helmet of salvation, or the sword of the Spirit into our hands when we need it the most, he makes them available to us, and he instructs us to use them when we need it. And so tonight we're considering the shield of faith. Now back then, the Roman army used several different kinds of shields, but two of them are prominent. One was a small shield. It was usually round and curled at the edges. And a foot soldier would strap it to his left forearm, and with it he could defend against the sword of his enemy. It left his right hand free for his own sword. So you had this small shield for hand-to-hand combat. But that's not the word that's used here when Paul talks about the shield of faith. The shield Paul had in mind was a large rectangular shield. It was made of wood covered in hide and framed in iron. And oftentimes they would soak the leather with water before going into battle. Why? Because one of the favorite ploys of the enemies back then was to shoot flaming arrows. They would dip the arrowhead in some kind of pitch or something and light it and then shoot it so that if it hit the roof of a building, let's say, it would set it on fire. Or if it actually hit a soldier, it would not only pierce them, but it would burn them at the same time. So these flaming arrows were very common, and so they would use these shields against it. Now, the word translated shield sometimes is translated door because it was huge. It was a big rectangular thing that was actually larger than the soldier himself. And sometimes you'll even see lines of police officers, if they're approaching a riot, they'll have these clear shields. And what do? They bring them together and form like a wall. And that's exactly what these were. These even had edges that you could connect the shields together and make like a wall of protection. That's the kind of shield that Paul talks about here. That the soldiers could interlock their shields and march like a solid wall against the enemy. And I think that's a great lesson for us as Christians. Because of our common bond and faith in Christ, we ought to be marching together. We're not called to fight the spiritual battles of our lives alone. That's why we need each other. That's why we're called to congregate as a church family. Hebrews says, do not forsake the assembling of yourselves together. Which put in 21st century terms is, go to church. Get involved in a church family. You need each other. Don't try to go out there as a lone ranger. Get together. You'll find strength in numbers, and you'll be able to stand against the enemy much more effectively. Just think of what God could accomplish in this world if each believer would come together and stand united against our common foe. Now, when do we need to take up our shield? Paul says in Ephesians 6:13, so that we'll be able to resist in the evil day. You say, well, what's the evil day? Well, that's when all hell breaks loose in your life. That's when you're under attack. It's when the finances are so low, you don't know how you're going to make it through the next week. Maybe you've lost your job and there's no new job in sight. It's when you're breaking down emotionally. You've lost all passion for life. Your marriage seems hopeless. Your kids have turned away. Your health deteriorates. Your future looks bleak. It's when your friend betrays you. It's when you're overcome by an addiction or an impulse. It's on that day, the evil day, that we need to be covered. We need to be protected. We need a shield. We need the shield of faith. Now, this faith here we're talking about, we're not talking about saving faith. We're talking about living faith. This is a trust in the promises of the power of God on a daily basis. And remember, it's not the amount of faith we have. It's where our faith is placed. We put our trust in a powerful God. And faith is acting on the truth whether we feel like it or not. It's acting on the truth whether I agree with it or not. Sometimes it means that we go against what everybody is telling us, but we do what God says. You know, we're told in Habakkuk 2:4, the righteous shall live by faith. And that means that faith becomes our regular way of thinking and doing and being. It's not the exception, it becomes the rule. So that whenever we come under the attack of the enemy, we choose to place our trust in the Lord. And that's how we gain the victory. That's how we find triumph over the terror of Satan and his forces. John Stott writes, faith lays hold of the promises of God in times of doubt and depression. And faith lays hold of the power of God in times of temptation. See, through faith, we can see our circumstances from God's perspective. And we trust him to carry us through times of trial, times of temptation. And we can stand in that evil day. Tony Evans points out, faith does not make God move. All faith does is access what God has already done. If you think that faith makes God move, you're going to be searching for a way to get more faith. However, as a Christian, you already have all the faith you're ever going to need to access anything God is doing for you. Jesus said that faith the size of a mustard seed could move a tree or a mountain. In other words, like the old TV ad says, a little dab will do you. You don't need more faith. You need to know more truth. That's because faith is the point of access, not the source of power. The power is in what God has already declared and done in grace when he deposited the seed of his divine life within you. As the knowledge and presence of God nourishes that seed, it expands and grows, offering you access to all that God has in store for you. All faith is doing is drawing on the grace that God has already put in deposit. So I want to encourage you to stop looking for more faith. You've got it all upside down if you think victory is coming by getting more faith. Faith accesses the grace of God that's already deposited on your behalf. Faith is only as valuable as the object of that faith. When the object is God's revealed truth, even the tiniest amount can move mountains. So as a child of God, as a member in the army of God, we're going to encounter many obstacles to our faith. And they may well come in the form of the terror of intimidation, maybe in the form of peer pressure or the squeeze of adverse opinions of others. Maybe it's the circumstances that are closing in. You know, we may feel like we're under that kind of an attack right now. We will never be out of the range of Satan's fiery darts, but we're given a shield by which they can be extinguished. And that shield is the shield of faith. And we have the confidence that Satan's fiery darts cannot penetrate the shield of a living, determined, dynamic faith in God. Now, every time that we run into these circumstances, we're faced with a decision. Are we going to allow ourselves to be terrified into submission and defeat? Or will we place our trust in the power and the promises of God to see beyond the immediate and the external and to see the eternal purpose of the Lord? When we choose the first, we will always lose. But when we choose to trust the Lord, when we take up the shield of faith, we will always triumph over the terrors of the spiritual realm. Every single time. Normally, we simply close our Sunday evening service in prayer, but Dixie, I'm going to ask if we can close with a hymn that is found on the back cover of your hymnal. I think this is a great opportunity to kind of reinforce the lesson of this message with the song, Victory in Jesus. Where do we find that victory? We're going to find it in our faith in Him. Let's stand together. We're going to sing the first verse, Victory in Jesus, as we close.